Since the turmoil of Brexit, the UK's Conservative government has splurged billions of dollars on expensive military projects, with plans to spend hundreds of billions more to project Britain's military might internationally. But while it's loosened the purse strings of military spending, the British government has tightened them on the country's underfunded public health system and on foreign aid, where it used to lead the way. The $5.5 billion cut will mean less relief for war-torn Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UN Secretary General has called the move a death sentence. The cuts also affect aid to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, and other life-saving projects in countries such as Syria, Ethiopia, and Afghanistan. Hundreds of charities, academics, and business leaders have signed a letter warning the government the cuts cast a shadow over the nation's role at the G7 and risk undermining its credibility on the world stage.
The amount of weapons that we are selling to be dropped on the head of the Yemenis on one side, and on the other side denying them any sort of support or cutting down those support, it really is outrageous, unacceptable.
The British government says its decision to slash foreign aid was a response to the economic shock brought on by the pandemic, meaning perhaps that once the health crisis blows over, foreign aid will go back to previous levels. Despite the pandemic, government aid designed to promote the economic development and welfare of developing countries rose to an all-time high last year, with the largest contributions coming from the U.S., followed by Germany. Britain took third place.
There is a fraction within the sort of extreme right who always wanted to cut our contribution to these countries, and they never believed in helping, giving a helping hand. And I think this is an excuse. Right now, it's an excuse to actually give in to those section of the Conservative Party.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing a rebellion at home from MPs, including his predecessor Theresa May, pushing the government to reconsider. Theirs and a growing number of other voices are urging Britain to be the world leader it claims to be. Saeed Puriza, London.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change. But as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Homa Lizgi, Vienna.
With With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television. As the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans, reporters try to extract more details through briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the atomic accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th.
While the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative, it did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the failure of Moscow talks, an Omani delegation along with the Yemeni negotiating delegation has arrived at Sana'a Airport as part of efforts to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen. Mohammed Abdusalam, who headed the Yemeni delegation at the talks, said the meeting was aimed at pushing up the humanitarian situation that has been deteriorating due to the all-out blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
The talks are held to discuss the overall situation in Yemen, including the peace talks and the humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Oman has always served as an arena for all Yemenis in political affairs, and today we are going to complete the efforts we made in Oman during the past months.
Observers say this move could make a difference in the political process, as Oman has always been beside Yemenis and realizes the circumstances of Yemen.
The Omani delegation is welcomed in our country because Oman has always been a good neighbor. We hope Oman could help us remove the current humanitarian crisis. We must have this point in mind that if the U.S. continues to link the humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the military realities on the ground, no progress would be made. Therefore, the humanitarian crisis in Yemen should be top on agenda.
The latest round of negotiations in Oman's capital, Muscat, failed to find a solution to the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. According to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, the Saudi-led coalition war on Yemen has killed almost a quarter of a million Yemenis, caused outbreaks of disease, turned Yemen into the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and brought the poor Arab country to the verge of famine.
Yemenis are optimistic about the Omani delegation visit to their country, saying Oman is capable of achieving what the UN envoy has failed during the past years and putting an end to the suffering of the war-ravaged nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As India continues to battle the deadly COVID-19 pandemic, the destitute Rohingya community fights it all alone. The community is not eligible to apply for vaccine, since they are described as illegal immigrants. Rights activists say they are in desperate need of help as the virus has started raging across the camps.
First they started the deportation drive, then detention, and now the lockdowns. Why are all miseries for us? Why is the world silent? Don't we have the right to live? We have no work due to lockdowns, and now this virus is frightening us since we can't get access to any healthcare services here.
The COVID-19 pandemic has brought more miseries to the community, since most of them used to work in the unorganized sector. Now, due to lockdowns, most of them have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity, while hunger and poverty looms over the community. The refugee camps are cramped, and the spread of virus is inevitable, they say, since their makeshift shanties lean on each other with no sanitation, food support, or health care, since they are not included in the government support programs. Most of them work as daily wage workers or scrap collectors to make a living, but the government restrictions and lockdown has left many out of work.
Some locals and NGOs are helping us with food and other essentials in these dire times. We, however, urge the UN Refugee Agency to play their part. We don't need just guidelines. We need access to vaccination.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different Indian states.
In recent weeks, many of these refugees, including children, have developed COVID-like symptoms. But due to lack of testing facilities and shortage of vaccine, they're on their own. Most of them have resorted to home remedies and self-quarantine. Many, however, fear if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine, a humanitarian disaster awaits their community. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Debate.
The discovery of remains of 215 children, some as young as three, at a former residential school in Canada has reopened wounds among the indigenous survivors of colonial Canadian schools. Yet, when it comes to condemning Canada, condemnations were very far and in between. In this edition of the debate, we will look at the depth of this problem in Canada and why the indigenous community and First Nation people continue to be discriminated and traumatized even to this day.
The last month's discovery of the remains of 215 children at a former Catholic school for indigenous students in Canada has reopened old wounds and fueled outrage in the country about the lack of information and accountability regarding violations of indigenous people's rights. On the weekend, thousands of Canadians took to the streets in Toronto to call for greater action from the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the country's infamous residential school system.
What they need to do is acknowledge that this was a wrong. What Trudeau doesn't want to acknowledge that it was a genocide. But there's actually been five genocides, the fifth one ongoing.
Demonstrators also tore down the statue of Egerton Ryerson, one of the architects of the residential school system at a Toronto university named after him. Following the discovery of the mass grave at a site of Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, Trudeau said it was a painful reminder of a shameful chapter in Canada's history and urged the Catholic Church to take responsibility for its role in such schools. Pope Francis expressed his pain over the discovery, but stopped short of offering a direct apology.
Seguo con dolore.
I follow with pain the news coming from Canada about the shocking discovery of the remains of 215 children, pupils of the Kamloops Indian Residential School in the province of British Columbia. I join the Canadian bishops and the entire Catholic Church in Canada in expressing my closeness to the Canadian people traumatized by the shocking news. The sad discovery further raises awareness of the pains and sufferings of the past.
Indigenous leaders and school survivors, however, dismissed the Pope's expression of pain, saying the Church needs to do much more. Between the 1870s and 1990s, more than 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend boarding schools which were run by churches and aimed to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children into the white Canadian society. The children were separated from their families and barred from speaking Indigenous languages, while they experienced physical, psychological, and sexual abuse, among other forms of mistreatment. More than 4,000 Indigenous children are known to have died at Canada's residential schools, but efforts continue to find others who never returned home. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that a country committed, quote, cultural genocide with its decades-long residential school system. Besides, reports suggest thousands of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or gone missing in the country over the past 30 years. Canada has touted itself as the first country in the world to adopt a multiculturalism policy. It has also depicted itself as an outspoken critic of racism and a leading advocate of human rights. Nonetheless, the discovery of the bodies at a former boarding school and lack of meaningful action on the issue of missing women and girls have raised serious questions about such claims.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, international human rights lawyer Edward Corgan, joins us from Ontario. We also have lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy joining us from London. Welcome to you both. Edward Corgan, let me first start with you. I mean, we did cover what happened in this tragic incident, but why don't you give us a quick wrap-up as to what actually occurred?
Well, there was a deliberate policy to assimilate the natives' children. They felt that the adult indigenous people were not couldn't be changed, but if they take the children, and the quote was to kill the Indian in the child. So children were ordered and taken from their families and forced to go to these schools. As many as 150,000 children were there, 138 schools, and the conditions were horrific. They were, they were cold, they were not proper ventilation. They would put children who were sick with tuberculosis in with the other children, so that at one school, I read that 69% of the children died, and they estimate that around 25% of the children who attended the schools did die, but they don't have proper record keeping. The 215 children's bodies that were found in Kamloops is just the tip of the iceberg. There's other schools where they found 15 bodies, and I think if they were to examine, the other schools, 138 schools, they would also find bodies there. They're buried in unmarked graves. They're not properly looked after. The families, in many cases, are not notified of the death of their children. It was just silence. And this is, government policy, government funding, run by the churches, and they were trying to, force them to convert to Christianity. They punished them if they spoke the native language. They didn't even have to speak English or French. And it really was like a penal colony. And you have, horrific treatment. And, of course, it didn't work. The native children didn't have the skills to compete, yet they were also torn away from their own societies and cultures and couldn't even maybe communicate with their parents because they knew English or French, but the parents did not. They only spoke Indigenous language. So it is horrific how these natives were treated. And it was based upon sort of the aggressive assimilation policy that was employed in the United States by General Ulysses Grant. But yeah, this is a really dark, terrible history, chapter in Canada's history.
It really is, and I'm looking down at some of the things that confirms some of the statements that you made there. And Jonathan Levy, I'd like to find out from you, why were they targeted in such a form and manner? Why, for example, would the church or the residential school system forcibly separate these First Nation children from their families? But in essence, why were they being targeted?
Well, as
Mr. Corrigan pointed out, there was a genocidal policy behind it. But in addition, there was already a policy in Canada of contracting with the Catholic Church to provide social services, and the provinces made money. They were paid money by the federal government. In the case of Quebec, 100,000 children went through orphanages and institutions. Some were First Nations people, and some were just simply from disadvantaged families. And the Catholic Church used them for medical experimentation, administered electroshock because they would be paid more money if the children were labeled psychiatric cases. And this went on for 20, 30 years in Quebec, and we're still trying to locate, you know, the mass graves from there. We know where some of them are. The group is called the Duplessis Orphans, and that's a subset of the larger problem in Canada and the terrible problem with the Catholic Church providing social services and everybody making money from it. It was not just genocide, but a corrupt financial bargain between some of the provincial governments and the Catholic Church.
Okay, again, I'm trying to get to the origins of how this all came about. So you have these First Nation children, and then you have the church, which is supposed to obviously spell religion, come and take them away from their parents and commit some of the most brutal acts that both you, both of our guests here have talked about. Jonathan Levy, you mentioned it, and Edward Corrigan, you also. It doesn't quite make sense as to why a church would do that, why they would do experiments on these children to go to that extreme. And it comes back to my question as to why they were being targeted in this form and manner. Edward Corrigan, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, it's basically racism. And the English settlers and the French settlers that came here thought that their society was superior to the natives. And the churches fought the same, and they wanted to take the children away from their indigenous beliefs, which were considered pagan, and turn them into Christians. And this was done, you know, in horrific ways through punishment. If the parents didn't release the children, they weren't able to get baby bonuses. And during this period, actually, Indians had no right to vote. If they got, you know, professional skills, they were removed, taken away from, you know, Indian status. They were, these experiments on food. There's a whole pile of different experiments where they would keep a test group and keep them, you know, malnourished, then try to have another group of children that would have different, you know, higher and better food. But it was, you know, it said, you look at these, it looks like terrible prison conditions of the worst kind. And, you know, the children were all packed in together. And so if one child had tuberculosis or any other diseases, it would spread to all the other children. So, you know, very high numbers of diseases affected the kids. And of course, many children died because they had inadequate food, inadequate health care, inadequate ventilation. And everything about this was a disaster. And the more numbers they had, the more money they got. But there was not enough money to look after the children properly. And, you know, the federal government provided some money, the province. You know, the province has control over education, but not with regard to the Indians. They were considered wards of the federal government. But they never were properly looked after. So you have these, you know, horrific memories being dragged back because of the discovery of the 215 graves. But there's, you know, probably, you know, 6,000 or more graves like this, and many people, they don't know who is buried there. And there's this, you know, these children just sort of disappeared. People ran away from the schools because they're so horrific, and they were punished severely if that happened. But the families weren't told, in many cases, you know, if their child died, and they were sent away from populated areas to try to minimize the contact between the families and the children, and this sort of aggressive assimilation project to turn, you know, the natives into, you know, good little, you know, English-speaking citizens or French-speaking citizens. And, you know, they were, you know, up until, you know, 1996 was the last school that closed, which is not that long ago. So this period And, you know, there were periodic reports, and the Truth and Reconciliation report is very, very important. And it, you know, termed that what was treated, how the Indian children were treated and the natives were treated was cultural genocide. So I agree with that. But, you know, this is over, you know, barely 25 years ago, and there was no punishment. You know, they're unmarked graves, and they build over stuff. And, you know, it's when they were putting in a water line, and they uncovered 15 bodies at one school. So there are many, many schools, and people estimate that perhaps as many 25% of the children who attended these schools ended up dying, you know, primarily of disease. But there was sexual abuse, physical abuse, and, you know, social and psychological abuse was all part and parcel of this attempt to assimilate the Indians and natives of indigenous people.
Okay, so we have expanded on that as much as we can. So we have an idea about the horrific experiences that these kids had. But could the possibility, Jonathan Levy, be that this is all about land? We know that Canada asserted control over indigenous people and lands. It was just in 1985 when indigenous people were viewed as citizens. So this is very recent. And I'm just trying to connect the dots here. If it's related in any sense that they are taking the kids away because these lands would eventually be transferred to the kids. But without the kids, then you have the adults that they have to deal with, which at some point they're going to pass away. Of course, then you have restrictions, you have discrimination exercised against them. Is that an outlook or a way to look at this situation?
Sadly, in Canada, there's been a lot of institutional abuse, and finances have also been, you know, the motivation. So, yeah, if you're committing genocide against a people, the idea is you are going to try to diminish them and perhaps take their land, which has always been a problem with the First Nations people. And of course, the entire institutional system with orphans in Canada was based on making money from the federal government. So there was a very strong profit motive involved. And, you know, the people involved should be punished both financially and morally for what they've done. Because, again, some of it was indeed trying to perhaps change the Indians into something they were not. But really, when you look at it, it was genocide. And the idea of genocide is to extinguish people.
Well, what about the Canadian government here, Edward Corrigan? I'm looking at the figure over here that the government had, committed to back in 2019. We can go and check that stat out. At $28.1 million was just allocated. Was $33.8 million was allocated for this. But you, out of that figure, $27.1 million has yet to be spent. Why is the Canadian president, who in his speeches does talk about the indigenous people and how they're being victimized, but not doing really much about it, as he's been criticized for?
Well, there was a $1.9 billion compensation fund that was set up by the federal government to compensate, you know, Indian Native children who were in the residential school system. They got $10,000 for if they were there for a year or part of a year, and then $3,000 for each additional year. But they had to sign a release that there would not be any other claim of compensation against the government or the churches. They did have some exemptions for, you know, sexual abuse and severe physical abuse, but this was a way of trying to, you know, hide the real extent of the problem and give, you know, what is probably fairly limited compensation for the treatment that these, you know, children received. Now, the Catholic Church has not formally apologized for its treatment. The Anglican Church, the United Church, and the Presbyterian Church have, in fact, apologized. But the Catholic Church, you know, was the largest provider of these schools, you know, in Quebec, across Canada. There's, you know, set over 138 of these schools. And you have, you know, it was sort of a sick system. People were sick. They were put to school, even if they were dying. And of course, if they have a disease that's contagious, it immediately gets spread to the other students that are in these, you know, close confined quarters. And it's, it is really sad when you're reading about these reports. You can't believe how bad it was. And there were some people who did try to solve the problem, and there was some talk of even getting rid of the reserve system. The reserve system in Canada actually is kind of like a system of apartheid, where the Indians keep on land, and the South African government at one point came up to study the reserve system in Canada to use it as a model for their own system of apartheid in South Africa. And I think that's a shocking revelation. If you think most Canadians would not say, oh, we never had apartheid, we're good, you know, we treat people properly. But unfortunately, it's the opposite of the case. There was really brutal treatment of these children. And, you know, cultural genocide, you know, bordering on, you know, physical genocide. And the orphans were taken away from the children, or even if they had parents, and were put up for adoption. You know, there's 20,000+ people were put through the orphan system. And, you know, it's a really sad, sad chapter of Canada's history. Now, hopefully, the federal government will, you know, take responsibility and also put the money in so that they can identify who, in fact, is buried in these unmarked graves, and provide some sort of compensation and closure for the families.
Well, right now the Canadian Prime Minister is actually, Jonathan Levy, criticizing the Catholic Church, aside from what our guest there, Edward Corrigan, says about the closure, that responsibility being in the hands of the government. The Church is supposed to come out, is supposed to take some responsibility here based on what the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has said. And there's been a lot of critique leveled against the Pope, that he has not come out with apology really on this, and for the for that institution to take responsibility. Why do you think that is?
Clearly duplicity involved here between both Trudeau and the Pope. The Canadian government can hold the Catholic Church through their various orders in Canada responsible if it had the will to do so. So what you're seeing here is the Canadian government can blame the church. The church doesn't apologize. The Canadian government says, well, we can't resolve this because the church isn't cooperating. The church knows where the graves are, where the grave sites are, and they're working behind the scenes, hand in glove, both of them trying to avoid greater liability. The Canadian government has done a settlement with some of the native peoples, but there is a similar problem with non-native peoples who were forced into orphanages run by the church for the profit motive. So that's why it's a duplicitous game between Trudeau and the Pope. The Pope is sort of, they're bouncing it off each other, neither one wanting to take responsibility. And indeed, the Catholic Church has escaped liability almost altogether in these matters. And they own vast tracts of land. They have the resources to make a settlement. And they're not accountable to anyone, even though Trudeau could hold them accountable if he wanted to.
Okay, in less than a minute, Edward Corrigan, discrimination against Indigenous people still happens. Is it being addressed properly, or is there a lack of this issue being addressed within Canada? Under a minute.
It's not being addressed properly because you still have, you know, much higher incarceration rates for the Native population. And, you know, you have alcoholism, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, a whole pile of psychiatric disorders, which stem from actually the residential school system, plus, you know, racism against, you know, our Indigenous population. I think one of the reasons why the Catholic Church doesn't want to give a formal apology is that because of legal liability, if they're admitting that they're responsible, that would be a strong base upon which to launch lawsuits against the Catholic Church and other churches. So the church is concerned about that. They want to limit their legal liability, but I think they should really take responsibility for this horrific period in the treatment of our Indigenous people.
Indeed. Thank you so much. We're going to end with the international human rights lawyer, Edward Corrigan. Thank you for your comments, and lawyer and academic Jonathan Levy there from London. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. So thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I've been Kavita Ahoy.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Srebrenica massacre remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War. More than a quarter of a century later, as new details emerge in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Middle East Eye. The piece is titled, Released Documents Reveal UK Planned Srebrenica Pullout Despite Being Aware of Imminent Carnage. Classified documents show the British government devised plans to withdraw troops from a besieged Muslim enclave at the height of the Serbian onslaught in Bosnia-Herzegovina in July of 1995. Despite being aware of mass killing of thousands by local Serb forces in nearby Srebrenica, nearly 8,300 Muslim men and boys were later found to have been murdered at Srebrenica after a Dutch contingent of the United Nations so-called peacekeeping force deployed in Bosnia withdrew from the town. The Srebrenica massacre, for which Bosnia's Serb leaders were later convicted of genocide, remains the single worst atrocity conducted on European soil since the end of the Second World War. More than a quarter of a century later, as the UK-based Middle East Eye News outlet reveals new details in a recent report about how Western powers and the United Nations contributed to other atrocities committed in Bosnia-Herzegovina. The report, which used declassified British government documents about Bosnian crisis, also points to a new widely acclaimed Bosnian movie, Quo Vadis, Ida, that sheds new light on the tragic carnage in Srebrenica and what it described as the catastrophic failure of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the region as Yugoslavia collapsed into war and violence. Quo Vadis, Ida, directed by Jasmila Zabanić, a survivor of the near four-year siege of the major Bosnian city of Sarajevo by local Serb forces, the movie has been nominated as the best international feature film at the 2021 Oscars and as the best foreign language film at the British BAFTA Awards. According to the released documents, another Bosnian Muslim enclave of Gorazde, where British soldiers made up the main contingent of United Nations peacekeepers, came very close to facing the same fate as Srebrenica. The documents paint a vivid behind-the-scenes picture of Western leaders striving to choose the least worst option presented to them by their advisors, without much regard for the fate of Bosnia's Muslim population facing massacres and other atrocities that were overtly being carried out by Serbian forces. They further reveal that the then British Prime Minister John Major was reluctant to reinforce Gorazde in order to protect his population of more than 30,000, despite, as his private secretary put it, the distressing scenes now daily on our television screens. The documents further show that the British Defence Ministry drafted emergency plans for the evacuation of British troops from the area around Gorazde in July of 1995, at the exact moment that genocidal slaughter was underway at Srebrenica and a third enclave in Zepa had come under attack. Gorazde had come under Bosnian Serb attack in 1994 and again in May of 1995. Gorazde, located on a strategically vital crossroads and surrounded by towering cliffs, was highly vulnerable to another Serbian attack and potential carnage following the fall of Srebrenica and Zepa. The report noted that three eastern towns had been declared safe havens for Muslim Bosniaks by the United Nations Security Council in 1993, after the surrounding territory had been captured by Belgrade-backed Bosnian Serb forces opposed to Bosnia and Herzegovina's declaration of independence in 1992. The report also pointed out that the UN Security Council resolutions had also established that United Nations peacekeepers were only authorized to deter attacks on the three enclaves, but not to protect or defend them. Force could be used only in self-defense. On 16th of July 1995, with a final onslaught against Gorazde thought to be imminent, British plans, codenamed Operation Screwdriver, to evacuate 350 British soldiers from the town of Gorazde was finalized at the Ministry of Defence in London. According to the report, the disclosure of the British evacuation plans came as little surprise to men who served in the Army of Bosnia-Herzegovina during the war. It then cited Farid Buljubasic, who had served as a lieutenant colonel in the Yugoslav National Army before commanding Bosnian forces in Gorazde from mid-1992 to the end of 1994, as recalling that the so-called United Nations Protection Force, or UNPROFOR, were being led largely by officers who did not understand the nature of the war. Farid Buljubasic recounted that NATO aircraft in 1994 bombed Serb tanks that had already been destroyed. He said, "I would say that the role of the international community in general in Bosnia and Herzegovina was very dishonorable." He further emphasized, "My general impression is that they never understood the character of war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, that they were never neutral, that they faked execution of their tasks, and there is so much evidence that they were extremely inclined towards the Serbs." He added, "They ignored and disregarded the government of Bosnia and Herzegovina, as well as the army of Bosnia and Herzegovina. There was politics in all of that." The released documents also make clear that the British Prime Minister at the time, John Major, was determined that the United Kingdom should not be sucked into war with Bosnian Serb forces, and that his senior military commander, Field Marshal Peter Inge, fully supported that decision. Farid Buljubasic further pointed out that a group of 20 British Special Air Service or SAS soldiers had been hurriedly evacuated from Gorazde whilst the enclave came under attack in April of 1994. He noted they had been posted to the town as the eyes and ears of UNPROFOR commander Michael Rose, who was himself a British general. Buljubasic added, "When they came, they were pumped up, dressed. They had vests, all sorts of things, camouflage paint. The very moment it got troubling, they vanished. He said, as the attacks went on, and as the Chetniks or Bosnian Serb forces were getting close to Gorazde, one night those SAS, a helicopter came to pick them up. They took their stuff and ran away without letting anyone know, without anything. They just disappeared. They just disappeared and vanished in one night. The former Bosnian commander observed that the behavior of the forces of UNPROFOR, the United Nations peacekeeping forces, would have been identical to the Dutch at Srebrenica, if not even more shameful. Meanwhile, U.S. President at the time, Bill Clinton, was expressing his frustration at the Bosnian government whilst they were struggling to defend themselves amid the United Nations-imposed arms embargo, whereas the Bosnian Serb forces had inherited large amounts of weaponry from the army of the former Yugoslavia. During a telephone conversation with John Major, Bill Clinton was recorded to have said, "We could hardly blame the Dutch for leaving Srebrenica when the Bosnians themselves had already given up the fight." He further claimed, "The Bosnians made a habit of trying to make other people look bad in the press." The report points out that some sections of the British record of these Clinton Major telephone conversations remain redacted more than a quarter century later on national security grounds, following the 2019 declassification of the bulk of the UK government papers on the period. Following the fall of Srebrenica and the attack on Zepa underway, British Prime Minister at the time John Major concluded that Bosnian Serbs would next turn to Gorazde, as the British ambassador in Belgrade reported that the Bosnian Serb army was under high after capturing Srebrenica with so little United Nations opposition and was dangerously unpredictable. However, John Major told both French President Jacques Chirac and US President Bill Clinton that he believed only diplomatic pressure should be applied in an attempt to save Gorazde. According to the report, the Americans regarded Gorazde as a problem for the British and French to deal with and regarded the defense of Sarajevo as a more serious strategic objective. The top British commander in Bosnia, Field Marshal Peter Inge, recommended that if the UK government decided its troops should remain in Gorazde, we should do so as robustly as possible, under a pure peacekeeping and humanitarian mandate option, and then seek a negotiated withdrawal with dignity, as the Dutch have done, but being prepared to use air power.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.